Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA, that's the important part, obviously stands for question and answer as we chew through some of the top news stories of the last week. Sometimes not even like the top, just some interesting news that we want to keep following up on, just see how those stories evolve. Want to spend a little time chewing on this stuff so that we don't just get outraged by headlines. And also why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday. Maybe some news broke over the week and we can kind of keep tabs on all of that here. I'm already seeing an incredible group here in the chat this morning, making this a more interactive conversation. Michael Corcoran, Drew Germain's Lens, Barry Johnson, Random Hobby, J-Man150, Mountain Dew Lou, Jimmy Fire Dragon, Lamprose Bros, Al Sabakli, Gabaletta, Ron Guido, Simon Says Hypno, Kapakosh, Bionic Scoop. We got a good crew. Good morning. Good. Merry time zone to you all, whenever you might be catching this. Of course, we always love the replay crew that likes to catch podcasts after this has gone out live. And H2O Taku is saying, hello, it's going to be a good show. I can kind of feel it. This is going to be good times. We've got some interesting stories to talk about this week. First of all, I just hope everybody had a lovely weekend. My cousin got married. He's just one of those incredible forces of personality kinds of cousins, like toured in improv and now does a little work in SEO, but, you know, still working like a comedy circuit and acting circuit, and just love him to death. And exactly the kind of situation that dudes are known for, where something really momentous in life changing is about to happen. But we're not super great at always communicating and keeping schedule and stuff for all the moving parts. So it was out here on the West Coast, and I had to drive down to go to this wedding. And the day before I'm set to drive down, I get a text from him saying, hey, so there's a special family ceremony before the wedding that my fiance's family, they really want to do this special prayer with these sort of religious figures in their church. And we don't, it's not for the whole family. This is not for everybody coming to the wedding. This is just for their little side of the family, something that they felt they needed to do, but it wouldn't be appropriate for the whole wedding. And I was wondering if you could just come down and you know, shoot some photos of it. Like, I've mentioned it on the podcast before. I have been booked on and shot exactly one wedding in my entire photography career, and it was the most nerve-wracking experience of my entire life, and I don't think I'll ever do one ever again. It's just the pressure to capture those moments, to make sure that those photos come out right. You don't get second chances. I mean, it's a big deal to the family, so it has to be a big deal to you too. And I wear my heart on my sleeve for stuff like that. I take it super personally. So I was like, hey, David, I don't know that I can like pack up gear and bring a whole extra bag and stuff, but I'd be happy to back you up. I'm sure the rest of the family is going to be shooting stuff from their phones and things too, so why don't I bring my phone, and that way at least you have someone who's not in the ceremony who can run around and take some photos that way. He's like, great, that's great, that's great. So I would just like to, this is very personal stuff, so I'm not going to be sharing it on social media, but I would like to point out, in a sea of iPhones, no photos came out looking better. This podcast not sponsored by Vivo, by the way. Every single, like, especially portrait, like head and shoulder shot that I took from the X100 Pro got like jaw drops. So thank you very much to the folks at Vivo. You made a great phone that came in clutch for me to be able to shoot a very precious religious ceremony for my cousin's wedding when he wasn't on top of making sure that the wedding photographer would be able to cover this little side religious ceremony. So that was my weekend. It was really lovely. It was really nice. This beautiful wedding out in like at a vineyard, and we always kind of turn these into these mini family reunions. And thankfully, her family and my family, they got along really well. Just you get a good vibe from people. Like, my family is all about any excuse for a party, and they were game to make this a wild and crazy kind of an event. And it was a nice little melding of two families, so it was really, really sweet. But, like, I get through this little sub-religious ceremony, and, I'm freaking out. Like, I don't know anything about your beliefs or practices. Please let me know if anything I'm doing is, like, religiously or culturally insensitive. Just please give me boundaries. What can I, can't I do? I'm taking photos of David getting ready before the ceremony. I mean, it was really, really, really sweet. But we get to the end of that, and we're like, well, I'm done for the day. I'm exhausted. Oh, wait. No, there's a whole actual wedding to go to and reception after that. It was like 9 o'clock at night, and I was like, I'm ready for bed. I'd had one drink and the champagne toast, and I was like sloppy on the floor. It was pretty bad. I'm definitely now a lightweight. I got to get myself back in shape if I'm ever going to tackle some kind of actual photography job again. Barry Johnson says, wait, what? The Vivo takes better photos than an iPhone? Say it isn't so, Juan. So, I'm bringing that up because, yeah, obviously the Vivo is a much better camera than the iPhone, especially when you're shooting stills and especially when you're trying to stay out of the way. Because a lot of this was like in a dark room. There was some like natural sunlight, but not at the angles that you would need to light up people. And for a lot of it, my cousin and his fiance were backlit. And that's exactly the kind of HDR stuff that Vivo does really well. I think it does better than almost anyone else. It's sort of low light, so you get that burst HDR illumination. And then it's painting in the background because we've got beautiful vistas behind them. It's just light is blasting them from behind. So without throwing a burst flash, which would have been the appropriate solution, is having like, one of my Panasonics, I would have put a little flash on that. This is really the next best thing. And it was kind of interesting, like at the little side ceremony, it took a while. I'm there with the phone and I'm taking a couple shots. I'm getting ready for kind of the setups, and everyone's running around with iPhones, and they would kind of keep peeking over to look at my photos. And it was almost like family member by family member by family member. They all stopped using their phones. It's like, okay, this guy doesn't have a real camera, but he's not an idiot. It was like, it took about an hour into that family gathering for everyone to kind of trust that I was at least going to get some good shots, even from a phone. But then they would look at those photos and like, well, how did you do that? And you're like, oh, you just used the zoom, or you set it to this, or I had to manually expose for that. And it was like a little bit of trust had to be established as we were doing that. But I was showing off things that like you literally physically cannot do with iPhone camera sensors. And that's what's exciting about seeing some competition with all of these different phones and all these different solutions. But I got to say, especially with like Scoop in the chat, and I think Jermaine would probably appreciate this, and Barry would probably appreciate this. I mean, everyone in the chat will probably appreciate this, but I just mean some more than others. I'm at the wedding, and a lot of my young... So we've got... My dad's side of the family is enormous. It was like... two brothers and a sister came to America through Ellis Island. And then each one of those people had like 7 or 8 kids. And then that's my dad's generation. And then from my dad's generation, each one of them had like 4 and 5 kids. So when by the time you get down to my generation, you've got like that order of magnitude growth for families and groups, and our you know, special events turn into these enormous family reunions. And we spread out, like, the Bagnells have spread all over the globe. There are Filipino Bagnells, there are Mexican Bagnells, we're Irish and German and Italian Bagnells. We're very multicultural. We're definitely the embodiment of that, like, early Americana idea of melting pot. Sorry, I digress. I'm at the ceremony, and I'm sitting at a table with mostly cousins, but there's, like, a schism. Like, there's a whole bunch of cousins my age, and then there's, like, a whole second group of cousins that are all about 10 years younger. So I'm sitting at that table. I'm the oldest one there by, like, 12 years. And at the table are a bunch of cousins holding standalone cameras. The one, she's, like, kind of the most fashionable of us and has kind of the healthiest Instagram following and really loves to do this kind of influencer-style travel documentation of her adventures. She's shooting on a little pocket Fuji. I mean, not like a mirrorless, like a little mini flip out screen, like kind of selfie camera, but it's a standalone camera. My aunt was back on a Nikon. Like, there were so many standalone cameras, even though obviously at a wedding, they've got a proper photographer, but that was just like this really exciting trend to see come back. It was like the enthusiast photography. This was a nice event, so I wanted to bring the nice camera. People traveling from all over the world. And again, this is one of those venues where no matter where you point your camera, you had an amazing landscape shot, right? It's out in the Southern California vineyard. And so it was just really heartening. It was really exciting to see. I'm definitely the phone photography snob. And I will say that some of my setups, better than what people were pulling off with their standalone cameras. I think I know what I'm doing. But it was like, yeah, I mean, like, well, we can't really count on our phone to do all this stuff. Like, that idea is starting to permeate in a really interesting way. And I think something is coming back, especially like a couple years out of the pandemic, people really getting back into travel, getting back into the flow of sort of going places and experiencing new things. And like, it's okay to have a specialty gadget, something that is designed to achieve a higher degree of proficiency or output in this specific task. You know, like maybe it'll be some sort of DAP style solution. And I really want to focus on just having a product that does my music the best it can do, because I can't count on my phone anymore. There's little things like that kind of build up, and I'm really glad to see it. It's really fun to kind of point that stuff out and show it off. But I did get a lot of like, wow, you must have wow, your phone's really good. And I would make the, well, you know, painter and his paintbrushes, you know. But I really do like this phone. So it was pretty great. Really, really enjoyed it. Hold on, I'm way behind in this chat here. Oh, Michael Corcoran saying the new desktop interface for YouTube on browser is tragically terrible. I've also been having a ton of buffering and slowdown issues. So I don't know. I'm watching a lot less YouTube than I used to be. Hold on. I saw another comment I wanted to get in here. Oh, we're still talking off. Oh, Kapakosh, there goes Juan showing off his photography prowess. I wish I could show you some of these. So it was explained to me that because this was a tiny family ceremony, that culturally it would not look appropriate to share photos because in their family, this was a ceremony that should have been joined by a larger community, and it would make it look like they were not in good standing with their community. And so I made them a promise I wasn't going to like share a bunch of these photos on social media, but it was really interesting because my mom and I were kind of the family historians on my mom's side of the family, not on my dad's side of the family. And we're looking at these different like different items of cultural significance and of religious significance, and the way that these things are decorated and how they present like food as a metaphor for abundance. And like, this is so Central American. Like, even some of the little like decorations look like papeles picados. Like, it looked like, yeah, like you could have done this in like Michoacan or in like Nuevo León, and it would look like kind of the same ceremony. It would look like kind of the same procession. So we kind of got it too. It was like, oh yeah, like if you came from this town and you didn't have a lot of people at this kind of a ceremony, it would look like no one likes you. So we, I made them the promise. Like, I sent everything to my cousin, and they seemed to appreciate the photos that I shot. And I think they liked a lot of, especially the couple. That's what I'm good at. I'm not a good portrait or staged photo photographer. I really love taking candids. So like catching that little glimpse as David like looks over at his fiance, or she's kind of looking up at him, or like the mom is sitting and you see she's getting a little teared up. Like, I love catching those moments. So a lot of those photos I got like, oh wow, that's an amazing shot, blah, 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 blah. But it was really lovely. It was really lovely to see. Oh, Nick Gay's asking, I really want to ask coprocessors. I'm seeing a lot of things coming out. Doesn't Vivo have a coprocessor like the Tensor on a Pixel? So, yeah, there is the V-Series coprocessor on Vivos, which is one of the reasons why I lean on Vivo harder than Xiaomi when I know I'm in for more difficult lighting conditions and darker lighting conditions. Like, especially when you drive a Vivo really hard into low light, it's like night vision, and you have to hold the phone steady like half as long as a Pixel. So like, you can get a very similar shot out of a Pixel, but when you bump up the brightness and it does that longer exposure, you've got to hold steady for a lot longer than a Vivo. I don't know what Vivo's magic sauce is, but they're doing really interesting things with stacking DNG files and abbreviating the exposure time. I had my Xiaomi 13 Ultra and I had my Vivo X100 Pro. I ended up not really shooting video just because the ceremony is sort of spread out wide in a really awkward way. And the only way I could have gotten good video of the whole thing is if my camera had kind of been like in the middle of the whole family, which if I'm not there to babysit it, then people moving around bump it. Like, it was just too much of a headache. So I opted to mostly just shoot stills. But in that situation, the Xiaomi is a very good indoor mixed lighting condition, HDR kind of solution. The Vivo is just better. And it's funny, like going from Ultras down to the X100 Pro, the not as good phone, it's that V series, that coprocessor that really pulls out a lot of that HDR processing quickly. It also helps with focus. Because, like, again, when you're backlit and you're kind of in a dark indoor condition with hard light coming from behind or coming at weird angles, even a really good, like a Pixel, which is really good at snapping on focus and locking on a subject, even that can kind of slow you down a bit, where I feel like Vivo is second only to Sony right now in like locking on a face, and not only on a face, but also locking on their eyeball to make sure that you've got everything in focus. Oh, Gabaletta. I mean, like, this is a very good reason why you'd maybe want to check a Xiaomi. I'm honestly eyeing the new Xiaomi 14 Ultra. The addition for macro on all sensors is a big hook for me. What you can pull off on these new close focusing telephotos is absolutely stunning. So like Xiaomi joining that now, like you being able to pull off some macro shots like I can pull off from my Vivo, that's good. That is a good reason. It pains me for how good the Pixel 8 Pro cameras are that I can't get close. I can't get nearly as close. And ultra wide macro shots don't really do it for me anymore. I've never been a big fan of them. I'm almost always taken a 2x zoom from the main sensor farther away than using the ultra wide as a macro. Now it's even better when you can telephoto, and that these telephotos are so much more useful indoors. Night and day difference than like Samsung and iPhones from last year. Oh, Jermaine, I hadn't heard a whole lot about this. But you're the second person I've read who says that this has kind of been an issue. I love the 14 Ultra, but in its current state, it isn't consistent enough, which is important. Like, for example, the Vivo. The one thing that does drag you on the Vivo is, even though it's got an enormous shot buffer, if, so like I was saying, backlit situation, and I'm going pop, 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 I'm letting the phone try to recover a little bit. I'm not trying to max out that buffer, but it's about every fourth or fifth image you sort of lose in succession. You sort of lose the HDR processing. Like, it gets gummed up, and then I have one photo which looks like I tried to do it on purpose. So it actually helped me, but this is not what I wanted it to do. But, you know, she's looking at him, he's looking at her, and I caught that moment where their eyes sort of met and you see that smile kind of spark up again, but the background is completely blown out. I wanted the vineyards in the background. It looks like I've made this angelic image of them. So what I did is I shifted that to black and white, harder contrast. You know, I did a little bit of editing to kind of pull out and dehaze some of the image. And that looks like an artistic, artsy, oh, he did, like, you know, kind of a backlit, you know, ooh, it looks so magical. That's not what I wanted to do, but I recovered. So stuff like that can definitely be an issue. But you're the second person I've heard that in, just generally, that the Xiaomi is struggling with some of its consistency. Vazikos, were the photos JPEG only or JPEG plus DNG? Actually, I switched between both. So in a lot of the backlight situations, I was feeling pretty comfy letting the phone take over as to get the HDR processing. In we did a couple outdoor portraits, and we did, like I said, David getting ready. I took him out on a little balcony and got some shots from there. And for those, because it was more of a hold still, let me get this photo, I was shifting between Super RAW and 50 ultra high res versions of those photos too. So it was really sort of dependent on the moment, what the conditions were, and what I felt like the phone could do well. For so many of the in ceremony photos, a Super RAW would have been great as a processed image just to help them reduce noise. They could do a final edit off of that DNG, but the way Super RAW stacks, you get a lot of motion blur. And especially in lower light conditions, you don't want that. But you could go normal JPEG or even sometimes action shot on the Vivo, and it freezes motion just a little bit better. So Nick A's, so does Vivo capture fastest pixels in Sony? I have a 2- and a 3-year-old that my Samsung struggles to capture. Ultimately, the Vivo is a more robust photography solution, but it's got a clumsier app than a Pixel. So I feel like Pixels do a really good job of freezing the moment you hit the shutter and then using, like, unblur editing to make a shot look crisper. A Vivo on full auto is probably going to be as frustrating as using a Samsung. But if you switch it to action shot, you get less of this HDR processed color dynamic range look, but it does a better job of snapping the moment that you capture. You just have to know what is different about this camera app and where to go looking for some of those settings. And then when you can hold still, what a Vivo can do with light and color is, I think, second to none. So again, it really depends. If you're in bright daylight shooting conditions, like great, great light to freeze action, I don't think anything beats a Sony. That Sony is razor wire sharp. It's locking on a face across a football field, freezing action. You've got enough light to keep a fast shutter speed. Sony's the gig. Vivo's pretty close, but it's not at Sony's level. So here, let me get this out of the way. I'm going to take a quick drink of coffee, and then I've got to celebrate some folks on Twitch real quick. And I don't even think my soundboard is going to work. So hold on one sec. Let me hydrate. All right, so I've got to throw a huge shout out of glory to Muppinish, who has gifted tier one subs to Pup on Tech, Laz Divine, Baby Gates, Random Hobby, and Dirty Lurker. I'm going to try this, but I don't know if it's going to work because my audio setup was super funky this morning. I played through my computer speaker, so I'm not even sure if y'all heard that. But if not, thank you so much for supporting the podcast on Twitch, on helping to keep this community rolling and keep these streams a-flowing. And also, excuse me, McCorkerin also subscribed with Prime, subscribed for 32 months, also gets a one terrible fanfare of glory. So apparently no one heard it. Yeah, I could hear it on my computer speakers, which means none of y'all were probably going to be able to hear it on stream. I don't know what's going on with Twitch. Every week, I don't change anything, and all of the audio settings don't work. It's just the hilariousness of how live streaming goes, because I also don't have any kind of monitoring channel to hear what you hear. So I have no idea what this sounds like to all of you out there. It's great. But no, I greatly appreciate folks not only dropping by, leaving these amazing comments. These are the conversations I love to get into. But also that you're willing to kind of help push the show along. If it's supporting here every week on the podcast or hitting my home site, somegadgetguide.com, and checking out some of those fun things that I've got. If you're doing a little shopping, or if it's joining the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. Literally none of this would exist without community support. Because let me tell you, YouTube and sponsored videos and ad revenue ain't getting it done. If it were that, I would have shuttered this channel. It's pretty great. So, we've got to knock out just a little housekeeping. I did get two videos out last week, even for prepping for family events and travel. I'm going to knock these out real quick. First of all, just I'm always excited to spend a little time with an Infinix. These brands like Infinix and Techno are delivering some really exciting bang for buck solutions. The new Note 40 Pro Plus 5G. It aims to be a sub-$300 phone, depending on market and region and currency and all that stuff. But it is a shockingly good amount of phone for sub-$300. Now, we have to assume you're probably not going to get crazy long software support for multiple years, but a phone that is borrowing design elements from significantly more expensive devices, has 100-watt fast charging, has 20-watt wireless charging and reverse wireless charging, and one functionally good camera sensor, even though there are three circles on the back of this phone, with a 4-LED ring flash like a Vivo V series, sub-$300 is... that's a lot of phone for sub-$300. So I put a video together on that. It's always just fascinating to see because that's kind of in the territory where we have cheap Motorolas here that are not as fun. They're probably better practical computing devices or maybe more powerful computing devices, but a $280 Moto is not going to be as fun as a Techno or an Infinix or some of these other side players in this space, where we're even starting to undercut what I feel is the value proposition of a Poco. Really cool stuff. Just really, really cool stuff. And then something near and dear to my heart, this was a really fun kind of homecoming video to put together. Beyer Dynamic is refreshing their headphone line. And a little more than a year ago, I got to test drive the DT700 Pro X headphones, but now they've got a refresh of the 770s. And you've seen the 770s on TK, like in our weekly Best of Our Week live stream. So now, taking the newer driver technology in the 700s, they've put that new driver in a pair of 770s and have tried to tune them so they feel like those old classic Beyer Dynamic Studio cans. I say in this video, like, my entire recording career has been dominated by three headphones: Sony MDR, Sennheiser HD25s, and Beyer Dynamic DT770s. So anytime we do a refresh on something like that, it makes me super anxious because these are headphones that we use out of habit and out of familiarity. And yeah, there are definitely weird things that happen with closed back cans for studio recording, but we know what they sound like. And we trust that, hey, when I mix on 770s or when I record on Sony MDRs, I know that when it sounds like this, I'm getting something out to the audience that will sound like that. So if you tell me there's a new driver in the 770s, it makes me super nervous. I do not want a new Coke version of a headphone that I have used, I mean, for like 15 years. I think my 770s are going on 15 years old. My HD25s are old enough to buy alcohol. I want to know that there's a replacement that I can trust. I know what this will sound like. So, yeah, a random hobby. We use 770 Pros for all our radio host and audio editing in the studio. They are such good solutions for comfortable long session recording. So I feel like they earned their rep in the talk radio days, and they continue to be a very good solution today. Like, if you want to record a long form podcast, get yourself some Shure dynamic broadcast mics and some DT770s, and you will not only look pro, but you'll have a very good solution to tackle an hour straight of active talking and active listening in a very professional fashion. So just beautiful. And you can get a sense of what I like and then some of my concerns with this new driver, the 770 Pro X. Is an interesting experience. Barry Johnson says, great list. I haven't been without the Sony MDRs or the V6 same headphone in over 20 years. I will be picking up the new Bear. Thanks for the commentary. And especially if you come from Sony's, you are going to hear a peaky version of your audio, a brighter version of your audio coming from Bear Dynamic. I feel like Bear Dynamic gave us a V-tune. You know, there's a natural lift to the lows because they're closed back cans. And to compensate for that, they gave us this bump in the highs that is often mocked and criticized. Real audiophiles love to point out, oh, this presence peak on the 770s, oh, so bright. But this is audio tuning from, like, I want to say 20 years ago. The 770s, I think, are probably 30-year-old cans at this point, maybe even older. And it's like the prototype that we developed before we gave consumers what we called deep V. Big bump to the bass, big bump to the air. It's a V shape that, like, kind of rattles your skull and makes everything nice and bright and juicy and colorful. And I don't like V tuning because it tends to roll over the mids, and I'm a mids junkie. But on 770s, it's like a proto deep V. Because you don't lose that articulation in the middle. I'm sorry, I'm spoiling the whole video. Just watch the video, I'll shut up right now, because that's the kind of stuff I talk about in my video. Excuse me. So yeah, Barry, I'll be very interested to hear your thoughts if you do pick up the 770 Pro X. Gabaletta says, side note, I just got my daughter a Moto Edge 2023, and I'm shockingly surprised with the phone. Only paid $350 for it. So the other big announcement, as we're kind of wrapping up housekeeping half hour into my podcast, because we had this big wedding, my mom and my dad, they drove out and they were able to drive up. So I was really excited. They spent a one extra day with us so they could see Lex play one of the last softball games of her softball season. My daughter, she definitely is like her father in being very emotionally affected by that kind of sentiment. Like, she it really meant a lot to her that my grandparents could come see her play. She had a pretty strong game too. Like, she had a really solid play at second. She got the ball, got it to first, got it back to the pitcher. I mean, like, it wasn't a double play, could have been close. But yeah, that meant a lot to her. But because my mom drove up, and she drove, she didn't fly, she had extra room to kind of carry some stuff with her. It looks like my mom will finally be retiring her OnePlus 6T.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Her six-year-old original battery, no other repairs or she's still using the original case that OnePlus sold for the 6T, that carbon fiber. She had the black 6T and the carbon fiber look. And it's time. It's time for her to finally move on to her next smartphone. So I brought down a couple things. The funny thing was, as a joke, the first phone I put in her hands was the Tank, the Tank 3 Pro. And we all had a good chuckle over what an incredible Boy Scout gadget this would have been when I was a Boy Scout. Like, oh man, it's got all this cool stuff and you could have done a projector at night. Oh, blah, 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 blah. But I put this in her hand just to kind of like fool the fingers. Because like every phone that she would legitimately be shopping now they haven't gotten bigger, but they've all gotten taller. So like opposite the OnePlus 6T, like a OnePlus 11 is actually just a hair skinnier, like narrower, but it's taller and it's heavier because it does have a bigger battery. So I put this in her hand first just to be a jerk. but we did. We kind of side-by-sided the OnePlus 12R and the OnePlus 11. And because she likes to go on a lot of like museum tours and art exhibits, and she's an avid quilter, and in quilting, there's a lot of like sharing photos and stuff. One of the things I showed her that kind of blew her mind, new phones all have that new text scanning tool. So she was complaining, like she got a template from one of her quilting friends and it's this off-axis shot. It's all trapezoidal. And they were like, oh, so yeah, can you print this out and use it? And you're like, no, because it's this odd, like, angular image. It's not perfectly straight. So I showed her, like, you might not be able to use this for, like, quilting, but if you hold something off, like, you're trying to get a good square-on view of a quilt, and you're off just a little bit, you can go into the text scanning or the document mode, and it's going to correct. And I showed her, it's like, you don't have to do anything. It just tracks what you put in front of it and it corrects for your access. It corrects for how the image is askew. So because of the better cameras, we opted to go OnePlus 11. So she is updating from her OnePlus 6T to a OnePlus 11. We got her all, I wiped out my old review unit, got her all set up. So I even still had the box. It was right, you can see the red right above my ball cap right there. So just behind it was the OnePlus 11 box. I didn't even remember I still had it. So we are finally retiring. It is finally time. We can say goodbye to the OnePlus 6T. And it was really interesting to talk her through what was new and different on the phone. It's still really OnePlus-y. Like, you go back to the OnePlus 6T and I remember all these people like, oh, well, Oxygen OS was so much better when it was more like stock Android. And you're like, yeah, but it's really not that different. One of the major, I mean, obviously all of the animations and sort of the look of Oxygen OS has evolved, but it's not radically functionally different. And one of the things that has changed is like, we have the new pop-out side panel, right? We've always had like alternative UI elements on OnePluses, but this one's a little bit more deliberate. But what's also improved are things like gestures. So my wife and my mom both use navigation buttons, but I was showing her, like, hey, if you're using gestures, what you can do is swipe and then pull into a floating window. And she was like, oh, okay, that makes sense, instead of going through a menu. And you're like, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that's really changed. That's the kind of stuff that's, I think, improved. But, like, none of what would make the OnePlus 11 exciting to me is any big perk for my mom. Like, the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. This is a laptop powerful chip. That isn't a concern. My mom is still completely satisfied with a Snapdragon 845. Like, my wife is now on a Tensor 3. She's not scratching deep into the capabilities of that kind of a chip, right? It's like, she's not touching any of that compute power. And again, I could show my mom, like, you could shoot video and edit it on device if that's something that you'd be interested in. But I think she would be more interested in, like, moving video clips over to a tablet and then editing from a larger canvas. I think that's, you know, dealing with eyesight and stuff like that, that's probably better for her. The only thing that seemed to, like, kind of click and resonate was the charging got even faster, the battery got bigger, and this was the year. The 8 Gen 2 is the year that I think we had the absolute best performance power management balance. As much as I glow over Snapdragon 845s and 55s and 65s, the farther we get away from the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, the more I think that that was kind of the year we nailed it. It's really high performance. It's incredible for playing graphics intense games. And it falls into a power balance and a low power mode better than almost any other phone I think I've ever used in my entire history of reviewing gadgets. And even against, like, a Snapdragon 8 Gen 3, which is a higher performing chip, has better AI capabilities, has all of these extra bells and whistles, it's all the stuff that I don't think anyone like my mom would care about. But if you drive that phone a little harder, it uses a lot more battery than the 8 Gen 2. It can eat up your battery more aggressively than the 8 Gen 2. GoStar Scream, hot take, the 855 was the last great Snapdragon chip. So the 855 is incredible. I've really come to love the 865 and the 875 by comparison. But I think we are in the golden age of old used phones. If you can direct your family to picking up Snapdragon 8 Gen 2s, I think that is the best performance per watt. I really do. When we were looking at Snapdragon 888s and 8 Gen 1s, you guys have heard me say this on the podcast before. I'm kind of repeating myself here, but, like, I wasn't really keen on telling people to buy older premium phones with those chips, even if you got a great deal on them. I didn't think they would age very well. I'm pulling out the OnePlus 11 again, and it's a screamer, and it's fast, and it's fluid, and it's performant. And I'm showing her, like, I mean, you're not going to play these kinds of games. Or you go to Netflix, you can get all these really great games for free, and it's awesome, and look, like, nothing slows this phone down. But for her use, I'm kind of guesstimating, a little napkin math, this might be a 3 to 4 day phone per charge for her. For her needs, for her use, I would not be surprised to have her go through setting it up, going a week, just kind of learning her behavior, getting all of her apps installed. Like, obviously, the first couple days are not going to be what the phone can really do. But after about a week of that kind of use, I would be very surprised if this phone needs more than 20 minutes on a charger every fourth day. I just kind of think, like, why can't we kind of push a more mid-rangery phone broader? Like, I feel a $400 phone in the United States that's still nicely built, but doesn't need all of this insane compute power, insane horsepower, graphics capabilities, but can focus on, like, I feel like the last time we had something like that was the Pixel 5a. That's what I feel more people would really care about. My mom is a techie. My mom, you know, she's got her degree in computer science. She knows what's going on the inside of her gadgets and computers. She is In fact, because of when she learned how to code, she's much more concerned about efficiency than she is, like, flashy UI elements, stuff like that. You tell her, like, oh, what we've done is minimized this stack, and we brought in these APIs, and we made this more efficient, and that improves your performance. You use less compute cycles to accomplish the same thing. She would be way more impressed with that than, well, yeah, I mean, the code's super inefficient, so what we did is gave you 15% more CPU power that then they'll just tack on extra software and you'll lose that performance after the next update. Like, she doesn't care about that. So this was kind of going a little bit long here, but I did want to highlight that because it does pull us into one of our top stories. I'm off my schedule, but here we go. So this one came in by Android Central, written up by Nicholas Diaz. Report claims the Snapdragon 8 Gen 4 might require larger batteries. I'll just do what you need to know. This is a pretty brief write-up. Newly surfaced rumors suggest Qualcomm's Snapdragon 8 Gen 4 could be quite taxing on upcoming smartphone batteries. Supposedly, smartphone makers may need to increase battery capacities to nearly 6,000 milliamp hour. But some are allegedly being tested with 5,500. Qualcomm Snapdragon 8 Gen 4 will feature its custom-made Orion CPU cores, rumored to reach 4 gigahertz in speed. So telling you this chip can go to 4 gigahertz. Gigahertz tell you almost nothing about the actual, like, compute power per watt. I am a little anxious because we've seen test devices from Qualcomm with Snapdragon X Elite at shockingly low power draw for a laptop. Those Orion cores in a fanless system, I mean, Qualcomm is saying a fully robust built thin and light notebook with like 64 gig of RAM and a terabyte of storage space and a nice bright monitor could come under like 25 watts. That's shockingly good for a laptop. That would be horrific in a phone. If your phone was drawing 25 watts at peak power. So we need to see what might happen with this next generation of Snapdragon chips, because we snapped back on the 8 Gen 2, actually technically on the 8 Plus Gen 1, the refreshed 8 Gen 1 that came from TSMC instead of Samsung. We snapped back in an incredible way. A higher performance than the 8 Gen 1 and better power efficiency than the 8 Gen 1. And I feel like the 8 Gen 2 kept us on that track, but the 8 Gen 3 took a step away from it. And I worry that the arms race between Qualcomm and MediaTek is being built on who can get the bigliest Geekbench score. And that doesn't help you at all. Having a bigger Geekbench score doesn't give you better performance in real apps that you use, and it doesn't indicate what's going to be a better sustained performance if you want to get more out of your phone before it runs too hot and starts throttling. The Dimensity that MediaTek has out now is laptop-grade powerful, but it can start peaking at like 13 watts, 15 watts, depending on whose analysis you've seen of the chip. That's too much for a phone with no cooling, with no fan. That's a lot. So it's concerning. I really want to see. This is going to be such a huge test for Qualcomm in phones at the end of this year and the phones that are going to be sold throughout next year in 2025. This is going to be a lot of scrutiny. We're walking away from ARM reference designs. The cores in this chip are not the sort of structure and design from ARM. Qualcomm is making their own custom core that's going to go into this next chip as it's going into the X Elite for laptops and tablets. There's going to be a lot of back and forth. Like, what does this chip do? How does it do it differently? How much power does it draw when it's doing this thing? It should be on a die shrink. We should be getting a benefit out of using a smaller fabrication node. And MediaTek is going to be likely still using ARM reference cores. So the Qualcomm versus MediaTek fight is even more precious because it shows off even more significant differences in chip design. So it makes me a little concerned if what we're seeing says, oh, we're going to need yet another 10% bump on battery capacity to make up for how much power the chip might draw. We're seeing that with the 8 Gen 3. Look at how many 8 Gen 3 phones are stepping up to a larger battery capacity over the 8 Gen 2. And I really feel from the 8 Gen 2, we could have taken an entire year off performance upgrades, or maybe like, I don't need more CPU compute, I don't need more GPU compute, but maybe you beefed up the NPU for all of this AI nonsense. Maybe it was that. But if we had done 8 Gen 2 on a die shrink, we made that process even smaller and more mature, I think we would have seen an incredible... I mean, because you can still drive the performance a little higher when you do a fabrication shrink. It uses less power, so when you bump up the power, you can actually drive those chips a little bit harder. I'm grossly oversimplifying complicated design. You should check out Dr. Ian over at Tech Tech Potato if you really want to deep dive into the nuances of chip design and fabrication. 8 Gen 4 taking us yet another step into bigger power. If I need a larger capacity battery, I'm worried our phones can't really passively get out that kind of heat. So we'll really have to keep a close eye on what happens to our phones coming into the end of this year. It's not going to be summed up in Geekbench. Or even like, I ran Geekbench 10 times in a row and you can see how the scores dropped. That's really dumb. That doesn't help you buy a phone. It's the laziest way. You can't think of any other way you can tax a phone for a half hour. I'm so over reviewers that think they're talking about something, but that's like the least meaningful way because it has no relation to what an actual person might do on that phone. No person is going, you know what I need to do is run dozens of tiny little compute tasks in quick succession with like a spike in performance and then a quick drop to recover and a spike in performance and a quick drop to recover because that's what smartphoning is. This is all really dumb. Let me take another drink of coffee here. From Colonel Corn Pop, wait, that's how good devices have become? I can barely get a full day out of my V60. So if you're comparing against the V60, I would say you're probably looking at some battery degradation because the V60 for me back in the day was roughly a two-day phone of my use. Not like full 48 hours of active use, but like, you know, from sunup to sundown, I was charging my V60 every other day. So it's, I thought the V60 was the battery champ of its era. But the 8 Gen 2, I feel, has improved upon what the V60 could do back in the day. Muppinish. Everyone knows the Snapdragon 888 was objectively the best one. Ken X, how is the 12R? I might get one by the end of the year. I have a video on it. If you go to theyoutube.com/WanBagnell, or I think it's youtube.com/@somegadgetguy, I've got a video on the 12R. I'm digging the 12R. Let me scroll down here. From Doomer, maybe this drag race between Qualcomm and MediaTek will give the edge to Google and Samsung next year. I don't think Samsung is going to snap back this next year. I think we're in for yet kind of another off year from Samsung where hopefully what Samsung has out against the 8 Gen 4 will be in better position to outpace the 8 Gen 3, if that makes sense. I feel like we're seeing a Samsung that is now roughly a year behind the sustained performance and the performance per watt of what Qualcomm and MediaTek can achieve. Because especially like Dimensity 9000 to Dimensity 9200, those are very power efficient chips. Like what MediaTek did was a generation ahead of Samsung. And then Qualcomm only leapfrogged MediaTek by leaving Samsung's chip fab. And we're watching them catch up. That's also why we had so many concerns over Tensor 2 specifically. Samsung radios, Samsung CPU core elements, a very unconventional Google design. But I don't think that's going to trigger. Once we see Google's chip design in TSMC's hands, I think that's when Tensor can make a more aggressive leap into competing directly against Qualcomm and MediaTek. I don't see it. I think Samsung is really going to be leaning hard on Qualcomm over 2025. I think that's going to be the relationship that we see play out. Scroll down. Grounded Tech. Well, I ran Geekbench 20 times. Suck it. I can't remember who I saw in a written review. Started saying like, well, obviously one of the best ways that we can performance test our phones is by doing things like rendering video. And it was on one of the Android sites. It was like Android Police or Android Central or something like that. And one of their new writers. And I'm like, gee, I wonder where they got that idea from. You know, I'm not saying I'm the only one, but I'm kind of the only one. I've been pointing this stuff out for a while now. And now it's just like, well, obviously, that's the thing. And all of those writers used to, like, talk poop at me about, well, I mean, what average consumer is editing video from their phone? Oh, wait, TikTok exists? They might want to do that. Well, obviously, the best way to performance test a phone is by video rendering and using some phones can render this video in, like, 15 seconds. I'm not bitter. I'm really not. Jojo the Techie, hello everyone, long time. Hey Jojo, how you doing? And we got Holla at Your Boy jumping in saying hey, greeting the whole chat. We got a good crew here. Get this out of the way. Technically, that was the end of housekeeping into our first story. All of the stories in housekeeping, all those links will be available on somegadgetguy.com. The blog post for this for this week's episode, Grounded Tech. The flailing hands really sells that rant. McCorkoran's Juan's impersonation of modern tech creators is really on fire today. I take my it's sort of I studied at the Bowfinger School of Acting. So there's that, you know, scene of, I can't remember who was the woman that was in that movie. There's this one scene where she's supposed to be so affected by what's going on, and you can tell she doesn't know what to do with her hands. That's basically how I treat my impersonation of tech reviewers. So, a couple quick stories we are going to chew through here now. First one is just a little science-y, and I wanted to bring this up as kind of an example. Who shared this? Someone shared this on the Discord, and I don't even think I have my Discord up because I am terrible at doing all the community stuff. Let me see if I can properly credit who shared this article. Because it was, Did you know, no mouse or keyboard, you can use keyboard mode to get around, to get started, tab, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. That was great. Scroll up. Was it H2O Taku or is it old Trev? I can't find it. Okay, we're just going to go. Sorry, whoever shared this, I apologize. So we just recently had an eclipse. And hey, Malik, salutations, good folks. And during the eclipse, for weeks before an eclipse, we like to point out, like, hey, you know, it's a real bad idea to stare at the sun. I know our president did it once, but he's kind of a doofus. So don't be like that. Get these eclipse glasses or look at all these fun science-y ways that you can kind of demonstrate an eclipse by filtering light through different devices and stuff. Emily's Wonder Lab. My daughter loved that show on Netflix. It's so stupid that she didn't get a season 2, but she's the one who's regularly doing these fun, like, explosive science demonstrations on the White House lawn and then having Secret Service freak out about, like, you know, look at this exchange between acids and bases, like a, you know, baking soda volcano. So anyway, even, you know, like so many YouTube videos, so many articles, local news talking about it. You would feel like as a general fog of osmosis information, even when the sky is starting to get darker, you don't just stare directly at the sun. So this story comes by way of, I IFL Science from James Felton over at iflscience.com. There was a concerning spike in certain Google searches right after the U.S. eclipse. And they have, like, the Google Trends data with these incredible spikes on searches like, my eyes hurt. You're like, oh no, that's a terrible trend to see play out. Like, where you feel like, hey, we've done a pretty good job of trying to set this up and educate people. And people making some jokes, like, they've got a Twitter post here from someone saying, back at my desk after staring at the eclipse for 13 minutes, and they've sort of blacked out the middle of the image. And it's obviously not, like, real. That's satirical. But to see that kind of trend data, especially, like, you can also track, has the solar eclipse passed through the United States, the states that were searching for that my eyes hurt, search term the most were states you can see they're darker through the path of the eclipse. So we're doomed. I don't know. Does anyone else feel like this is a good indication of where we're at as a species? I feel we're doomed. I don't know. How do you get information out any better to people that, like, this is a really dumb and dangerous thing to do, but it's like, oh, I see the sun in the sky, like, every day. And you're like, yeah, but you're not staring at it. How do you fix for that? Or, I don't know, it's just very upsetting to me. Obviously, here in California for this last eclipse, we only had kind of a partial occlusion. We only had, like, a little dip in, dip out. And one of the parents in my daughter's class was so sweet, donated eclipse glasses. We have two second grade classes, and they donated eclipse glasses enough for both and all the teachers. So all of the second graders got to go out, and the teachers, my daughter was saying, like, oh yeah, Senora Diaz was super strict. Like, okay, turn around and look. And then she would count down 60 seconds. Okay, turn around and rest your eyes. And then, like, you know, they would do other activities like holding up colanders and things where the light could shine through and you could see the shadow of the sun making that reflection. And they were only allowed to do it three times. And you're like, okay, yeah, this sounds like a teacher who actually knew what was going on. And even with these glasses, we're trying to make sure that even the kids who weren't paying attention and were looking up at the sky through sheer peer pressure. And the whole, like, monkey see, monkey do, like, oh, I'm looking around. What are all the other kids doing? Oh, they're looking up at the sun? Okay. That even if they weren't properly using the glasses, weren't looking at the sun for very long before all the other kids would turn around. And then those kids would be like, oh, I don't know. They're looking at the ground now. What's on the ground? Like, even accounting for second graders not listening and following instructions, they were on top of, don't do this, that's dumb. How do you get that message out to grown-ups? Like, it makes sense, but it seems like so many grown-ups need a Senora Diaz to, like, come in and, like, whack them with a ruler or something. Our school doesn't do any kind of corporal punishment, but I just mean that kind of strict, almost like Catholic school kind of behavior. If you're over 40 and you're staring at the sun and then you think, oh god, my eyes really hurt from, I wonder what changed, I better Google why my eyes hurt. Oh boy, that's a troubling. I can't just noodle it through. My thinker isn't putting those bits together for me. I don't know that you can fix that person. Jojo the Techie. Yeah, humanity is done. yeah, McCorcoran 3, and it's really sweet because we had a bunch from the last eclipse that we saw out in New Mexico. Some family friend picked us up a pair of those eclipse goggles, and it's just really, it was like a really nice gesture. That's really cool that people were, and that we can still kind of get excited about space stuff in a really sciencey way. Not for the people that were acting like it's some harbinger of doom and religion and stuff like that, but, you know, from Malik, oh man, these are the same people who think plants crave electrolytes. So my wife and I were telling my mom, my mom has never seen Idiocracy. I feel a lot of the setup to Idiocracy actually hasn't aged well and is increasingly mean-spirited in its depiction of, like, dumb people procreating in a very eugenics-y kind of way. I feel like the setup to the premise isn't as funny or as fun as it used to be. But in part, it's also because so many trends in Idiocracy have kind of played out and come true. So now there are other parts of Idiocracy that are a lot funnier because of just how crazy real life has become. So yeah, but we were telling my mom about it, and it's like, you know, it's electrolytes. It's what my body craves. So what are electrolytes? Oh. Oh, Dr. Claw, it's really exciting to see, isn't it? Dr. Claw says, I live in the Cleveland area where there was a total eclipse. The experience of watching the sky go from sunny to nighttime was surreal. And for the last, it wasn't, I forget what that's called, but we had the ring. So the moon didn't completely block the sun, but it passed completely in front of the sun, creating that, I forget what term they use. It's like occlusion or something like that. And someone will correct me in the chat. But how even all of nature changes. Like, you take for granted just the noise. You know, we were out on the mountain in New Mexico, and you take for granted like insect noises and rustling sounds, and there was a deer that crossed our path, and then the eclipse starts happening, and then like everything shuts down, and it's like eerie quiet as nature is trying to figure out, like, is it nighttime? This is weird, but I guess it's time to go to sleep. And then the moon completes its journey in front of the sun, and then everything kind of wakes back up again. It's super eerie, and surreal is a perfect way to describe that. Simon says, Hypno, it's the willful stupidity that gets me. Oh, and Dr. Claw is like, I says, I tried to take pictures of it, but I don't think my device was up to speed. And it's really better if you didn't prep for it. So I got a good ring photo from, I might have been the Pixel 7 for that last New Mexican eclipse. I can't remember if it was the 7 or the 8. But anyway, I took one of those eclipse goggle glasses, and I cut out the light filter in that glass, and then I taped it on top of the telephoto sensor for the Pixel, and that's how I got my ring photo of the eclipse. Like, if you just point your phone camera at the sun for any length of time, you'll probably burn out your phone camera. It's pretty bad. From Bray Gray, LOL, some people are just rebels. Is that rebellious? It doesn't sound rebellious to me. I'm just saying, it's pretty funny. Steve Pogue says, yeah, we're all living in the dark timeline of history. Simon says, Hypno, no natural or man-made laws apply to me. That's what I'm talking about. Annular, thank you, John Gow. I knew someone would correct me here. Annular solar eclipse. So the different types of eclipses where the moon is capable of completely blocking the sun or is sort of in the center. And in New Mexico, it was like perfectly bullseye, dead center, but you could still see a ring of the sun around it. Was just, again, it's just an incredible spectacle to see. I love kind of sharing the science on stuff like that, but it makes me very concerned. Jojo the Techie, if it can burn out the sensor in your camera, imagine what it'll do to your eyes. And you know what, Jojo? Apparently that idea never got across to people who were interested in looking up at the sky, but couldn't factor the incredible power of the sun.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Thanks, Juan Carlos, for allowing me to be part of your show. And I want to introduce myself to you guys. My name is TK Bay, and I've been doing YouTube for quite some time, almost 10 years now. And you can find me online by just looking for TK Bay, either on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. But the general consensus is I'm a tech reviewer. I provide an interesting way of approaching tech by the same way you would actually go ask your friend for help. That's generally the consensus of how my channel runs. I review anything from Android, iOS, PC computers, scooters, basically, you know, drones, anything that you think of as consumer tech. I generally try to get my hands on it and share with you guys my opinions. And of course, any troubleshooting or even tips and tricks that can help you enjoy your tech even better. Again, thank you very much to Juan Carlos. But if you'd like to check me out, just look for at TKDSL8655 on Instagram and Twitter, or TK Bay in YouTube.
Yeah. Seriously, grounded tech. An eclipse is magical. And magical in the best science-y kind of way. Oh, Ron Guido, I got a lot of family who are in the same boat. It was very cloudy where I am, unfortunately. So hopefully, again, I know Lex has been very interested in this as a science-y phenomenon. And so she's even been tracking, like, oh, and I hear there's going to be another one in 2026. And you're like, yep, we might start traveling out and going on vacation to places where solar eclipses happen. I don't know. That'd be cool. It'd just be a fun, like, you know, I'm not going to ever be game to be like a storm chaser or something like that, but eclipse chaser, that could be a fun hobby and maybe worth like bringing out a nicer camera and setting it up properly. So, moving right along. In another case of really dumb things happening because of dumb software and dumb people, Twitter's Grok. Yeah, you know, Twitter has its own AI, which seems pretty terrible. And, well, let's just read through a little bit of this here from Ars Technica, written up by Ashley Bellinger. Elon Musk's Grok keeps making up fake news based on ex-users' jokes. Twitter likely hopes to avoid liability with disclaimer that Grok can, quote, make mistakes. X's chatbot Grok is supposed to be an AI engine crunching the platform's posts to surface and summarize breaking news, but this week's Grok's flaws were once again exposed when the chatbot got confused and falsely accused an NBA star of criminal vandalism. Klay Thompson accused in bizarre brick vandalism spree, Grok's headline in an AI-powered trending tab post that has remained on Twitter for days. Beneath the headline, Grok went into even more detail. This is a quote from Grok. In a bizarre turn of events, NBA star Klay Thompson has been accused of vandalizing multiple houses with bricks in Sacramento. Authorities are investigating the claims after several individuals reported their houses being damaged with windows shattered by bricks. Klay Thompson has not yet issued a statement regarding the accusations. The incidents have left the community shaken, but no injuries were reported. The motive behind the alleged vandalism remains unclear. And then from people, making this joke and kind of repeating this joke, it seems like kind of bots that are just copy-pasting the same, first off, I'm okay, my house was vandalized by bricks. After my hands stopped shaking, I managed to call the sheriff. They were quick to respond. My window was gone, and the police asked if I knew who did it, and I said yes, it was Klay Thompson. But we've got, like, four tweets in a row from different Twitter accounts, some of them with blue check marks, that are just copy-pasting the same bad joke, which is now being picked up by this AI and being spread as an actual news piece. And at some point, again, our technological abilities and capabilities for absorbing language from social media and reorganizing that into things that sound official and newsy has completely escaped the gravitational pull of our current ability to regulate. It's way off in the cosmos, and we're now struggling to catch up with the ramifications of something like this. So, to me, it would make sense that at some point, there probably needs to be a lawsuit against Grok for defamation. It is perpetuating and signal boosting a completely untrue story about a celebrity, a famous athlete, And it doesn't matter if Grok does that to, like, a normal person, we don't care. But because this person is a famous athlete, well, now something has to happen, and look, Grok is hallucinating, and this is not good. And I don't think that you can signal boost untrueness like that and then just walk it back with a little disclaimer like, oh, well, you know, sometimes Jeff lies. You know, Jeff. What a scamp. At some point, someone says, no, that's not okay, because what Jeff did has erupted as a story on this platform, and it's not true, and that does damage to this individual's career or livelihood or just the presentation of their brand as an individual or as a person or as an athlete. So I'll be very curious to see how this one plays out. So apparently, Klay Thompson has not, at least at the time that this was reported on by Ars Technica, had not issued any statements. And then why I would also recommend catching the full list on this article, Ashley Bellinger does a really great job of kind of summing up just how bad Grok is. It's one of the more reckless chatbots. It's had numerous issues with spreading disinformation and disseminating bad data. And it kind of goes like hand in hand with this entire catastrophe of a strategy from Elon Musk running all of his brands into the ground because of how he wanted to own, handle, and manage Twitter. And now this AI went from being something that, like, oh, if you pay $20 a month, what was it? It wasn't 20, it was like 15. If you pay like $15 a month to Twitter, you can use Grok too. And then they were like, no one's using Grok. Okay, what if you do it for free? You can use Grok now. It's terrible. I had a lot of conversations with, like, my older aunts and uncles. Just, like, one of my uncles he's adorable, but he's like, yeah, I got this book, AI for Dummies, and it's, like, this thick. And, like, the first third of it is pretty easy stuff to understand, but then it gets really obtuse. And you're like, yeah, you know, it doesn't need to be. They're kind of making it obtuse to make it seem like it's something super special that no one can figure out but the brainy people, and that they're the magical technologists that are ushering in an AI... It's basically just a really dumb version of your keyboard autocorrect. And he went, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense. So it's just sort of sucking up this information from other places and then just sort of rearranging the words. Like, in the case of Grok especially, yeah, that's kind of what it's doing. Simon says, Hypno, Grok is now renamed George Santos AI. It's so bad. Gabaletta says, where I work, we're starting to use AI tools to predict, plan how the commercial deliveries are being managed and assigned. Let me tell you, they suck. And I don't know, I don't know that we really covered it last week as much as I wanted to. But like the story came out that Amazon's AI-powered commerce solution is apparently just total garbage. So it came out like there's a team in India, actual humans that are watching people shop in these Amazon Fresh stores, and Amazon has sold their system to other retailers. So you don't need to have checkout lanes, you don't need to have people self-checkout. It's just they pick something up off the shelf, and cameras and AI track all this stuff, and that's how they do the sale, and you're just billed automatically. So magical. And Amazon has been selling this as the solution for years. Well, last week it kind of came out again. Amazon said they had a team in India just verifying the AI. But increasingly, we've noticed that, like, these transactions through Amazon Fresh do not happen in real time. You walk out the store and you have all this stuff in your cart. And then, like, 4 hours later is really when you get the bill and the final, like, tally and, like, you know, all of the Amazon shopping information is emailed to you. Which, to me, doesn't seem like AI. Like, to me, if it's really able to track people through the store, I'm not saying it should happen instantaneously the second you walk out of the building, but should happen sooner than what is practical, what practically happens, what functionally happens at an Amazon Fresh. So now it seems to be more, the AI is really bad at tracking shopping behavior beyond like two items. that it like starts falling apart when the complexity of the shopping cart increases. And so really it's human labor in a very Snowpiercer kind of way. Like, oh, just don't pay any attention to this data center in India where we have people staring at these screens 24/7, 365 to try and account for people pulling things off shelves from remote camera systems halfway around the world. It's totally AI. Am I right, guys? It doesn't really do, it can't really do what they say it can do. And I was having conversation with family members. My brother was kind of super depressed about, like, well, we've disrupted all these other industries. Like, look at Uber and cabs. And not saying, like, cabs are great, but, like, Uber is not a sustainable business model. And eventually it's just going to be kind of become worse than cabs. But, like, we didn't bring any technology improvements. We kind of just made everything worse. And AI is like another step in that direction. The way that we're selling it as this kind of corporate solution or business solution, what Gabaletta is doing for like trying to use this as a way to, you know, like actually functionally accomplish some new part of your job is really stupid. It's not functional. And it takes an incredible amount of energy and resources and power. And we talked about that at the end of last week's podcast too. Just like, man, this stuff is horrifically expensive, uses a ton of electricity and natural resources and water to power, and it isn't capable of doing what they claim it can do. This, to me, is starting to look like yet another NFT-style rug pull. We've got to boost up all the initial excitement. These companies desperately want government contracts. They want the federal government tied into some kind of AI service where they're getting tax dollars. So once you have that, the government on the hook, then you get all of the tax dollars. And that's really how you keep your business afloat, like SpaceX. But it's not a real thing. It doesn't really do stuff that accounts for how much energy it requires to set up. There is no growth in AI. There is no startup that can pull good software developers over to a tiny little company to disrupt the AI market, because really good software developers and engineers don't want to go to a little startup that doesn't have good resources. They want to go to Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft and Google and maybe Apple, whoever Apple decides to buy out for AI, because they don't really have the AI themselves. But they want a data center. They don't want, hey, we got a couple like GPUs and some 4090s, and yeah, we're a little upstart in Sacramento, and we're going to get some VC cash. It's going to be great. You can't, there is no growth. AI is already spoken for if it's server side. Who can own and operate servers? That's it. AI game is donezo. All anyone can do in the AI space is make an app that can run on someone else's framework. No one is going to be building, especially server side, no one is going to be building the next phase of AI tools in a garage. So to me, that is a dead market. If you can't find any solution to step in as a new player or disrupt or find novelty or do something exciting, and you are totally beholden, you will always be renting or leasing time on someone else's mainframe. You don't have a secure business model. You don't have unique and distinct intellectual property that you can leverage into the next generation of products and services. You will always be an add-on to someone else's intellectual property. Yeah, Gabaletta, I can only imagine the amount of cameras, tracking software, AI software overlapping to try and make this happen. Ever since we started shifting to these new tools, every commercial manager has to put up with this has complained about how much it sucks. Gabaletta, sorry, one more. It has increased delivery times by at least 10%, dwell times by at least 15. So it's like, yeah, this was stupid, horrifically expensive. The people who came in to consult on it all got fat paychecks, and it's made you less productive. That sounds like AI to me right now. Yeah. Yeah. oh, we've got this thing like writing, you know, technical data. Well, you need a bunch of humans to fix it. You could have just had the humans write it in the first place. So this is just something I think we need to keep our eyes on. Moving on to our next stories. This is a pair of stories that we need to keep an eye on. I use Discord. It's one of the perks. A Patreon. It's a private Discord. I really enjoy the community that chats on the regular. It's very casual. It's very chill. It's a fun place to just kind of hang out, support each other. We've got like a little fitness crew. We've got some foodies. It's really nice. Some fun with photography challenges, stuff like that. And I really love kind of hanging out in my own Discord, shockingly. But if something changes in Discord as a service, we'll probably need to leave at some point and find some other alternative to how we host those topics and discussions, and we get to hang out with fun, like-minded nerds. So this is one that you really want to keep an eye on. There we go. From 404 Media, written up by Joseph Cox, a spy site is scraping Discord and selling users' messages. An online service is scraping Discord servers en masse, archiving and tracking users' messages and activity across servers, including what voice channels they join, and then selling access to that data for as little as $5. Called SpyPet, the service's creator says it scrapes more than 10,000 Discord servers. It scrapes more than 10,000 Discord servers, and besides selling access to anyone with cryptocurrency, it's also offering the data for training AI models or to assist law enforcement agencies, according to its website. So, not great. You would have some kind of expectation that if you have a Discord, and it's a private Discord, that you should be able to sort of weather someone just coming in and leeching all of the information in your Discord. We shouldn't have an expectation of any more significant privacy on a platform like Discord, but because of the way that it's built as kind of a more chat room style environment, instant messaging style environment, I think we've always kind of compartmentalized and treated Discord as something different than Reddit. But unfortunately, and especially if you're not really locking down your Discord, but even if you do, like I have a private Discord, it's really not significantly difficult to get around Discord's security policy, it seems. But if you have kind of a more open invite, open invitation Discord, it's apparently not very difficult to get in there and just get all the information out of it. And then someone wants specific information, they can pay this service to go and find it, or they can hand it off to law enforcement. As to whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, I feel a lot of people in this chat would probably be privacy minded enough to say, law enforcement should have a warrant to get information from its servers. If you're dumb enough to put up incriminating information on your iCloud, then Apple has sort of a responsibility to comply with law enforcement requests when a warrant is served to pull someone's data off of an iCloud server. That data is on a server in Apple's possession, so the user should have no expectations of privacy or security. Anything that Apple can be served from, like a warrant, Apple has to comply with law enforcement. We've got another story about Apple's complicit nature coming up here soon. Discord is kind of similar. Reddit is kind of similar. After a certain point, there should like actually be no expectation of privacy. If you haven't made the platform yourself and coded the interactions between individual users, you're using someone else's servers. But it's very upsetting when, like with ISPs, so cell phone carriers track everything you do on your phones and they sell off that data to whoever might request it. And it is not incredibly difficult or expensive to get granular data that can fingerprint someone through their use and their behavior. We talked about this years ago. We were able to track Trump's secret security agents. His secret security detail was trackable through their cell phones, and it was not expensive to get that information and see their movements and see what they were up to. So that's one of the sort of EU regulatory issues that I think will kind of play out here eventually in the United States, is to say, and there was a court case recently where there was a pushback on evidence that had been accrued by law enforcement buying access to proprietary user data. I might have that wrong. I'll have to look that up. Maybe we'll follow that up on next week's podcast. But there needs to be. Like, if you want this, a judge used to say, like, well, you got to get a warrant. You got to get this signed off. You can't just go and track all this stuff, and that's not admissible in court. And it seems like, yet again, that is another functional difference in how technology operates that our legal system is completely unprepared for. Go Starscream. But one, companies shouldn't be beholden to the knee. But one, companies shouldn't be beholden to the knee by a country. If a company doesn't like said company laws, I think you mean country laws, they should just leave. Slash sarcasm, which is kind of funny because the follow-up story that we also need to keep an eye on, and I'm very anxious about because I like Discord, but I don't want to stay married to Discord if Discord starts to in-poopify, is Discord wants to void your right to sue them in court, but you can opt out of the practice. So I got this from Simon de Roquefort, Simone de Roquefort over on Polygon, and they're you know, updated terms of service, and in this they're trying to force now binding arbitration. And we've got, like, clauses and stuff in this new TOS, but there is a way that you can opt out of it. Users can write an email to arbitration-opt-out@discord.com within 30 days of April 15th, or when you first register your Discord account, whichever is later. The NCLC has a template that you can download, and it's not complicated. So if you just want to opt out, include the date, and most importantly, keep a copy for your records. A corporation won't do that for you. So if you're concerned about things like, hey, you've done some really scummy things, Discord, and I feel like a class action lawsuit is an appropriate market correction for your bad business behavior, you'll want to make sure that you've done this, because it is not a casually easy thing to do, apparently, in your Discord settings, which again, to me, reeks of anti-consumer business practices that the FTC should be starting to examine. And I will maybe send a message to the FTC. I'll write them an email saying, hey, this is a platform, this is a service that I really enjoy. I pay a lot of money to boost servers, but they are now engaging in a business practice that is not easily correctable through their own settings as they have changed the terms of service. So it is a punitive change to the terms of service, weakening consumer recourse if abuse is found, and to opt out of it requires you to engage off of their service to correct for their binding arbitration rules in their new TOS. I don't know about you, but that kind of fits the textbook definitions of anti-consumer business practices. So, Go Starscream, you got to discard that Discord. It's like, it's interesting because, like, it's actually front of mind now for a lot of people. Like, so many of my family members talking about the Apple DOJ case. And again, I don't think many of them are actively looking to dump their iPhones. Most of my family is on iPhones, especially my dad's side of the family. My mom's side of the family is a really healthy mix of a variety of different Androids and iPhones. But, like, I'm talking to one of my uncles, my Uncle Dan, and he's like, yeah, I just don't think I'm going to try and buy a phone for a really long time now. I just don't like what Apple's doing. And so you sit him down, you're like, oh, Uncle Dan, you know, you can always go and get your battery refreshed. I mean, you like your phone, you live your life through your phone. But his idea, like, oh man, I just don't know what I'm going to do in another year when I've got to replace my phone. And you're like, well, you could go to an Apple store, give them like $100, get the battery replaced, and it's going to be like you've got the brand new version of your phone again. Are you doing anything new? Like, do you want to play crazy graphics intense games? He's like, no. And like, well, what about the camera on your phone? Are you really trying to shoot? He's like, nah, I almost never use the camera on my phone. And you're like, well, first of all, you shouldn't have bought a Pro. But you're like, instead of spending like $800 on a new iPhone, get a battery replacement and it should give you another 2 or 3 years of your style of use out of that. And it's like, anything I can do to kind of guerrilla warfare, how can I hurt Apple's pocketbooks? Because I think their business practices have been incredibly abhorrent. Now we're starting to see some of this other mindset, some of these other ideas start percolating throughout all of these web services, throughout all of our social media, throughout services like Reddit, how this is affecting things like stock prices, because I've got a few bankers in the family. They are not up on tech, but man, when we see stock prices monkeying around, they get very interested in what these companies are doing. It's like a little bubbling of an idea that's starting to spread that, like, what we're doing now is unsustainable and it's really not okay. And instead of just going, oh, I don't know what you're going to do, I guess I just need to buy another iPhone, my uncle was actively thinking about, what do I do when it's time to buy another iPhone? That is a terrible place for Apple to be. So much of their marketing and so much of their user base is built on this lock-in of familiarity and feel-good marketing. They don't want you thinking about that upgrade. It's a foregone conclusion. You're going to get the new iPhone when it's time to flip your phone. And a few more people just kind of spreading that idea like, oh, well, you know what? Hey, you know, if I don't need to flip my iPhone, my wife probably doesn't. She doesn't do anything crazy on her iPhone. Oh, you know what? I should tell my kids. Like, he's got a phone issued for work and he has a personal iPhone. Maybe he doesn't need to flip his iPhone either. Yeah, it's like that little bit of a trickle, just planting the seed and like seeing what kind of grows from it it's just really sweet and delicious. I feel like so many of our tech companies need that kind of direct confrontational market correction on their behaviors. I do actually have an Apple story. I am not qualified to speak on this very much, but it's written up by my man crush, John Brodkin, over at Ars Technica. So I would prefer you read through this story because, like John always does, it is incredibly well-sourced and linked between one of the ways that we're seeing sort of Chinese and U.S. Aggressiveness playing out in the business sector are the social media apps that came from American companies now starting to get banned in China as we are saber-rattling about services like TikTok. So China orders Apple to remove Meta apps after, quote, inflammatory posts about the president. And so I want to get to, this is the statement from Apple. Quote, we are obligated to follow the laws in the countries where we operate, even when we disagree. The Cyberspace Administration of China ordered the removal of these apps from the China storefront based on their national security concerns. These apps remain available for download on all other storefronts where they appear. So we're primarily talking about WhatsApp. Oh, WhatsApp, Threads, and then Apple has also removed Telegram and Signal from their Chinese storefront also. The Wall Street Journal paraphrased a person familiar with the matter as saying that the Chinese cyberspace agency, quote, asked Apple to remove WhatsApp and Threads from the App Store because both contain political content that includes problematic mentions of the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. So, again, Apple bills itself as an American company, but it kind of lives in Ireland, I think, still, to pay lower international taxes. That's changed over the last couple of years. That Ireland tax haven isn't quite as aggressive as it used to be, but Apple still accrues all of this offshore money that they occasionally dump into the United States whenever we give them a grace period on taxes. Like, for some reason, Apple just, oh, they should never have to pay taxes because Apple is our shining shield against China bad technology and gadgets, which is so stupid. But they do have to comply in the regions that they do business, or they could say, hey, we don't want to do business in that region. But of course, money and shareholders and stock price must go up, rocket to the moon. This is, of course, arriving at the same time as we're seeing TikTok face increasing scrutiny and increasing pressure from our Congress. There was a committee that voted unanimously to then push forward a bill that would mandate TikTok ByteDance sells its business to a more favorable entity to the United States, which is kind of an anti-business standpoint. TikTok was operating within the letter of United States law, and it seems overly aggressively punitive and singular to focus on TikTok while declaring China an adversary in this bill's language, to then say, but this one company is different. If it had been, hey, we don't like what TikTok is doing, we don't like their business practices, we don't like how their algorithm targets different consumers and can sometimes be very unhealthy for people facing mental health issues, then that would be a bill that would broadly apply to YouTube and to Facebook and to Twitter and Instagram and Threads and all of these other permutations of terrible social media. But that's not what our government did. So it's not incredibly surprising that now China's saying, oh, but Facebook, bad too. If you're going to ban TikTok, then we'll ban Threads. And you know it's got to be bad to a degree that this is escalating the way that it is. Because for one, it's very clear that Chinese authorities have been able to see all of the info in these apps to be concerned that there are problematic depictions of the Chinese government and the Chinese president. They know that that information is being disseminated on platforms like Threads and Telegram and Signal because of the way that Chinese ROMs on Chinese phones in China spread that information to apps and services that can be directly communicative with the Chinese government. So to me, what we're witnessing is an escalation in this Chinese policy, because if I were an authoritarian government, I would love to have the illusion of some kind of private person-to-person communication, like a WhatsApp, in this environment so that I would be able to find those dissidents. I would be able to find those people spreading that information. But now it seems we've gotten to a point where they're pretty confident in how they can track their own citizens' behavior, and that it's now a better image for China to get rid of these American apps and to play that on a global political stage, and that it has superseded the data, the value of that intelligence data that they're currently able to accrue on people using those services in China. So that is a very concerning development. Like reading between the lines on all of this, and I'm definitely putting on a bit of a tinfoil hat, but that to me sort of speaks that China has sort of exhausted the value of tracking people through services like WhatsApp in China, and now they're ready to kind of wall that off. It makes me concerned for the life of the Chinese citizen who is increasingly left with little recourse, little ability to even just vent. I mean, just think about the emotional requirement of, I'm not terribly impressed with the political process in the United States right now, and I will occasionally send a message to my wife saying, like, I can't believe this BS. Did you see what just happened here? And she goes, I know, right? Everything sucks. We're doomed. And we all go, and then we have to finish our day, right? But even that kind of an exchange can be viewed as very antisocial for the social credit score that you maintain in China. And now there's like even less safety. There's less hiding in that kind of a situation. So not terribly surprised. I know we knew Apple was going to capitulate. We knew Apple was going to play ball. That's the necessity of their business model. And internationally, when we look at Apple and their marketing about like privacy and security, it's only as good as what the local laws are. The same thing happens in Russia. There are sort of these mandated apps and experiences and software that need to be on phones per the requirements of the Russian government. And that's kind of the same for an iPhone too. So it really only comes down to like whatever presidential administration comes up next. If they say, nope, you got to give us all the data on our enemies Apple's going to be one of the first to go, oh, that's, I wish we could fight them. They used to be that. Remember when law enforcement was like, you've got to unlock the iPhone and break encryption on the iPhone. Apple pushed back against that. It's not the Apple we have today. They're not going to make that kind of broad political stance against China because there's too much money involved at this sort of late stage capitalistic market for cell phones and technology now. So it's disappointing. It's very upsetting that we're kind of getting to that place. But that's also why I like hanging out on Mastodon. Let me take another drink of coffee here.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
From H2O Taku, LOL, TikTok has people easily disproving misinformation by billion or corporate-owned media. Sure, there's a lot of brain rot there, too, but the other thing is probably why they want it gone so much. Then Gabaletta, as much as I don't like TikTok, a government forcing a company to sell off part of its company to another because that government disagrees with the country that company is from is bonkers. And that's a good word, Gabaletta. It is legit, just mind-numbingly dumb. And again, it is very like tone deaf in the saber rattling, like, oh, you can't do that, but also don't do that to our American companies. Oh, can you believe it? They're trying to ban Facebook. And you're like, yeah, it's pretty easy to understand why you would want to do that. It's pretty easy to understand why they're making that play. Guys, this isn't some grand mystery here. Ooh, Ghost Star Scream. Juan, would you rather deal with China or Russia? I know which one I'd rather prefer. It's definitely not the latter. Boy, howdy. I would be anxious about either for, I mean, kind of somewhat different reasons, but I would really want to not have to contend with being careful for either China or Russia. I am kind of a bumble doofus on the internet who doesn't always know when to keep his trap shut. And while I had a lovely visit in Shenzhen, getting to tour an Oppo manufacturing facility, I think my history of political discourse, even in this limited state doing a Twitch podcast every week, would probably make me not a very well-regarded individual in some circles if they did even just a little bit of digging in how I like to comment on technological issues and sort of empowering users to find things like encrypted channels of communication. So I kind of feel like neither is really a great place for me to visit anytime soon. So it's pretty gross. And I'm really bad at playing the sort of diplomatic political side of these kinds of conversations. So it's not great. Just real quick, I think this is going to be either a really good thing or a slow, painful, and ponderous adaptation for our Android devices. How many people here in the chat, as I go on to tell the story, obviously the chat is a little bit behind my actual stream here, so I'll get into it. But how many people here are just really tired of hearing about, like, structural changes at trillion-dollar massive tech companies that are stapling different departments together, just like, you know, we see in tech editorial, where the people who are writing reviews are now under the umbrella of the people who do all of the affiliate marketing. And that makes us trust, like, the review less, right? And then we hear, like, oh, well, at Microsoft, they're getting rid of this one division, but then adding this other team into this division, and that's going to be under that. And now we've got ads in our start menu on Windows 11. So I saw this headline, and I wanted to be kind of excited about it, but I'm honestly just a little tired of hearing about these kinds of changes and things coming. This was from the actual Google blog, you know, the keyword blog.google, building for our AI future, from CEO of Google and Alphabet, Sundar Pichai. First of all, just hearing the title, building for our AI future, kind of made me roll my eyes so hard I dislocated an eyeball. But an editor's note, today Google and Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai shared a number of structural changes to improve velocity and execution across the company. His note to employees is below. Hi, Googlers. We're coming off an amazing Cloud Next. Congrats again to all involved. It was nice to see the recognition of our leading AI tools and infrastructure and all the ways our customers are using them. Excited to show more progress during our earnings call next Thursday. Today, I want to share some changes we're making across the company to simplify decisions and help us work better and faster. There's context below for the changes in four parts. 1. Models and research. 2. Responsible AI. 3. Platforms and devices. And 4. Mission first. It's a long note, but I want you to see the full rationale. And the thing that I think is actually going to directly affect us nerds is that third point, platform and devices. So Google is stapling together the teams responsible for a lot of the software and services in Android and of Android itself to under Rick Osterloh's department, which was more focused on the hardware and devices part of Google's catalog. And, you know, like, in years past, if you had told me, like, hey, the team that's going to be responsible for the software is going to be working directly under the team that's responsible for designing and building the devices and the hardware, I think I would have been a little bit more positive on that kind of change in a very Apple vertical kind of way. That would have made me a little bit more excited. Today, it makes me more anxious in that I don't see how, like, the Pixel team doesn't get some kind of unfair advantage if Rick Osterloh is in charge of those hardware products and all of the software team responsible for Android reports to him. How do you firewall that off? Because remember, like, back in the day, if you're an old nerd like I am, when Google bought Motorola, eek, gnashing of teeth, so many concerns. Google's going to give Motorola unfair access. They're going to be able to do things, and like, it's going to be like competition from, like, the Nexus divisions. And how do you feel as, like, a Samsung or an LG if you know that your Moto competition is directly? And Google promised, oh, what we're going to do is we're going to separate this. Motorola is going to be a vendor just like any other cell phone maker, even though we bought them mostly for patents and their, you know, R&D division, sold off the scrap to Lenovo, is basically just like a name at this point. I don't think you can kind of make the same claim that there's going to be a proper buffering and firewalling off between Android software and Google hardware services. The devices and platform restructuring here, I feel it's going to be really good for Pixels. I really like my Pixel 8 Pro. I've been spending a little time just kind of noodling around and playing with the betas on my Pixel Fold. Love these products. Both of those phones were sent to me by Google PR. Hashtag gift from Google, hashtag Team Pixel. Though they haven't obviously required any kind of editorial from me. There's been no exchange. They're not sponsoring this podcast. There's nothing like that. And I've not sought any editorial confirmations or approvals for any of the stuff that I make. This one makes me a little anxious. I don't know if folks here are kind of in the same boat of, we've been watching what used to be sort of the broad, exciting, competitive flavor of Android sort of erode at the edges and simplify and unify. And now there's a more streamlined idea of what a phone as an appliance can be. And this to me is another step in that direction, which for a couple companies is likely to be a positive step in improving the vertical, the Apple-like vertical of optimizing software to work directly on this kind of hardware. But beyond, you know, Google and Samsung, because Samsung and Google are working really closely these days, it would make me concerned over all of the other competitive aspects of Android, everyone else getting kind of a second tier relationship with Google. One of the reasons I feel this way is, I didn't put this in the show notes, but like, I need to reach out to the folks over at Mobvoi. So they're testing a Wear OS 4 beta. And you look at like the resources Mobvoi has compared to the resources that Google or Samsung have. And, you know, like I'm wearing a OnePlus Watch 2 right now. Oppo, that's a pretty big company. They've got resources to play with a smartwatch to keep that up to date. Google wants Oppo, Xiaomi, Samsung all using Wear OS. Those kinds of companies are getting preferential access to newer software builds and support from Google. Fossil left the smartwatch scene. Mobvoi is months behind on setting up a beta. To me, the situation with Wear OS was a warning. And now, with Google stitching together Android, this what do they call it? Platforms and devices into one unit, into one organization under the Alphabet umbrella, makes me nervous that in another year or two, is that what we're going to see for phones and tablets? Pixel is going to be the tip of the spear. Okay, that kind of makes sense. Google phone, Google software, Google hardware. Okay. But now it's even more directly affixed to that as a vertical. And then a company like Samsung sells the most phones. So yeah, Samsung's going to get let into that club. And Xiaomi's the number three. They're probably going to get better access. But what about a disruptive low-cost phone? What about a Tecno? Or what about or even a Motorola? You know, are they going to be, or a Sony? I think actually, you know, like a Sony would be a really good example of this. They are a crown jewel ideal of a really expensive ultra premium smartphone, but they don't sell enough units to have a lot of sway over Android as a platform. So do they get pushed to the side? Do they get secondary access to Google and services and support, where Samsung is basically in the office with the Pixel team getting more direct access? And it's in these kind of feel-good mission statement-y notes from the CEO that we get these little glimpses and we get these little clues as to what might be happening with these massive tech corporations, but we don't get good information on what is this working relationship going to look like with other developers and engineers and product managers and companies. And that's what makes me really, really twitchy. It makes me really anxious. I don't know. I've met so many incredible people at Google that are just incredible. I mean, just fantastic at what they do. And I feel like Google and Microsoft are just lacking that last bit of follow through on good executive leadership, good executive decisions to move these products and services into like the next phase of consumer adoption. And like my mom, like she doesn't have an iPad anymore. And she listens to her podcasts mostly on a tablet. And she decided to pick up a Google tablet. She got all of her podcasts transferred over. She was in the old podcast app from Google. And she doesn't want to use YouTube. Too complicated. The old Google podcast app was totally her speed. Simple, streamlined, straightforward. She made the effort to put her information into that and it's gone. That's super frustrating. This policy, this direction that Google is on right now is doing so much damage to their reputation, and it's not the Googlers on the ground. It's not the individual developers and engineers dictating the course of this company. It's executive leadership saying, we're only excited when you make a new app, and then we'll try and get all of the users of the old app to use the new app, and then those people go, you know what, this is annoying. I'm just going to go get an iPhone. So I'm sorry, I've got like lots of, like Doomer left a pretty long comment here. Let me read through this from Doomer. The merging of Android Pixel and AI teams make me so hopeless of Android's future, and I would not be surprised if the whole Android tinkering space dies out completely in the next 3 to 5 years. As someone with some experience and in touch with many way more skilled device maintainers, the actions of Google from last year, beginning with Android QPRs, and now with forcing of checksum checks of proprietary blobs, why should talented people waste time in anything to do with Google and Android? And that has definitely been, a very loud concern from a lot of the folks in like the custom ROM scene. And like, I'll be on Mastodon where you get really, really nerdy developers and you're like, oh yeah, I got this new update to this like custom ROM. And I'll go and I'll see like, hey, I would really like to give this a try. I have not been up on flashing ROMs for a while and they're getting Android 14 on like older devices. Let me see, like maybe if I pull out like maybe I pull out like a OnePlus 10. Maybe I could see. And you go through and you see these lists and it's like, yeah, we're up to date. You've got Android 14 on a OnePlus 5. And you're like, you can't. I mean, like, I get it. It is really exciting. You're keeping older phones working longer. But it's also like, if I can't try this on a Pixel 7 Pro, Doomer's point here, like, it's not really a thing. And we're increasingly finding those opportunities to make Android devices more like iPhones, not necessarily in the same disastrous consumer policy like serializing parts. Like, there are plenty of Pixel repair parts, but when Google decides, like, hey, we're kind of done giving you software, it's getting harder and harder to work around that and to find opportunities to keep these devices working out in the ecosystem longer. Yeah, Kabakash, I don't see Apple killing their podcast app in favor of shoving it into their music app. Instead, they're improving it, which is a message completely lost on Google executives right now. You've crafted a developer community that is only excited by newness and novelty. It's up to the executive leadership to say, hey, we've got to make it way more exciting to polish and improve and iterate and bring features and keep it easy to use. And you see that, like, the Pixel camera app is a great example of how awesome you can make the consumer experience when you're forced to iterate and improve on that app's structure and design. So do that to the podcast app. Rename it YouTube Podcasts. Keep the app. Don't make me dump the app because you want to roll it into some other music service. That's flipping stupid. And so instead, like, my mom's now on Podcast Addict. It was like, she did a Google search and said, hey, what's the best podcast app? And she got Podcast Addict. So congratulations, Google, you played yourself. She's not interested in YouTube music. she's not going to follow you on these kinds of shenanigans. So now, instead of having that like behavior data and that interaction and all those services tied together, she is now taking a step outside the Google ecosystem to fulfill a need that you have taken away. You had a solution for it, and now you don't. And I don't know how to get that message across, because I can't believe for a second that there is so much apathy that people aren't switching up how they use some of these products and services. Right now, Google is too big for them to care, but that erosion is playing out in real time. That erosion is starting to affect the front of mind concerns of consumers and is starting to increasingly pick up on the radar of regulators, who are very interested in what kind of fines they can levy trillion-dollar market cap companies. One more news story here in Eivind, E-I-V-I-N-D. I think I've been saying Elvind for the last couple times I've seen your name pop up, and I've been incorrect, so I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Writes, is there any chance at all for Huawei to get back into Google? Because they make real flagships sold here in Norway with no Android, sadly. I do not believe Huawei is interested at all in returning to Google flavors of Android. They are now one of the fastest growing brands in China. They are shaking up the EU with not having, not having any reliance on Google services. Again, this is, to me, is a good example of consumers starting to change their behavior. I was talking to my uncle. He was like, yeah, I really like Apple Maps. I even think it's better than Google Maps now. And you're like, yeah, there are a lot of things. You're probably right. I don't use Apple Maps, but I have not been happy with recent changes to Google Maps. And then I told him about Here Maps. Like, yeah, you're planning that trip. When you're overseas, like, also back it up with Here Maps. Use Apple Maps and Here Maps, but Here Maps is going to be downloaded directly onto the device, and you don't have to use any data. It's really, really cool. He's like, oh, yeah, yeah. This idea that average consumers are so afraid of changing their behavior. Now, granted, my uncle used to work for IBM. My mom is a computer programmer. I come from a family of teachers and engineers, so I totally acknowledge that when I describe this stuff, I don't just automatically get eyes glazing over. They'll go with me on a little bit of it. But my uncle is also about to turn 70. So describing this stuff to him, as long as you're sort of excited about it, happy about it, oh, you should check this out. This is really cool. You should really look into this, as opposed to, you know, breathing through your teeth, you know, they'll go with you on it. And it's that emotional connection. I have always used Google Maps. I'm familiar with Google Maps. Oh, you know, I tried Apple Maps and it didn't suck. Completely pops that balloon of confidence and apathy that Google has over their products and services. Mention an alternative, plant that seed. Are they immediately going to jump in, change all of their behavior? No. But Huawei has stuck to it. Huawei has not been trying to ingratiate themselves or return to this kind of Android, Google flavor of Android dominance. And now we're starting to see that play out, especially in a time period where we're very critical of major corporate big data policy and decisions, which is funny because it's also Huawei, but still. Because that's the last story that I actually had as a link. I'm very anxious to see what the Pura 70 Ultra can do. So the Huawei sort of set the stage for the current generation of camera improvements that we're all benefiting from today. I don't think anyone would argue with me that it was Huawei and Leica's collaboration that sort of catapulted phone cameras into a higher tier of performance and optics. And this new Pura is notable because it is using a 1-inch type sensor. I'm not sure if they say what sensor's in it. So I don't know if it's a Sony sensor or if it might be maybe one of these new OmniVisions. I don't know. But it has this new mechanical extension. So when you're not using the camera, the lens and the assembly seat into the body of the phone. It makes the bulge a little less dramatic. But then you turn on the camera and it pushes out so that it can have not only, I think it's a 30 millimeter equivalent field of view. I have to look this up. I read through this thing and I have completely forgotten. Let's see. It's a 1-inch camera sensor. Yeah, they don't actually say it, do they? 35, 40 megapixels. I don't know. I want to say it's something like a 30. It's not the same, like, wide 23 millimeter equivalent that we often see. But because this entire housing and assembly poke out from the phone and this little motor helps give you the proper depth, it gives us a slightly different focal length, a slightly narrower. John Gow saying it's a 22.5 millimeter equivalent. I had heard that it was going to be a little bit narrower than that. I had heard that it was going to be a 30. Oh, they achieved the 28 millimeter equivalent by cropping. Okay, I could buy that. That's not as fun. But still, what's kind of cool is that because this entire assembly pokes out the way it does, it still does have that variable aperture also. So this isn't extension for zoom. It's to help mitigate how big do I have? Yeah. So I was showing people off like the Vivo at this wedding and just like how much I'm in love with this phone. But then you hold it up next to an iPhone and you show them like, well, this huge ring is necessary for how the depth that you need on these camera sensors to achieve the optical characteristics of these photos. And they go, oh, yeah, but that's so big. My iPhone doesn't have... Yeah, it's actually not that much different. But you do need a little extra depth. So here, we can kind of create a module, just like on the Vivo. There's like an outer module and then a ring on top. We can kind of create that, but then we've got a camera sensor that seats into that outer module. Saves us a little bit of space. It's not quite so absurdly large all the time. And then when you need it, it pops out, and we've got a variable aperture to kind of to work with that as well. So, again, a question of like what we're talking about with Huawei and being competitive. Huawei's not coming back to Google, and they've kind of demonstrated that they don't need to. And they're making a ton of money, and their sales are skyrocketing, especially throughout China. As we see that proliferation of this as a competitive piece, Huawei hardware has always been bonkers good, just incredibly good. And their camera performance has been phenomenal. So even though they don't even have their Leica collaboration, that Leica collaboration has moved on to Xiaomi, they learned an incredible amount about making a good phone camera, and they have their badge is now Xmage. And that's their own proprietary photography processing stack. And it's incredible. I really want to try and get my hands on this Pura. I'm not sure if I'll be able to land it right away. But what are we saying? It's going to be the Pura 70 Ultra with all of these fancy bells and whistles is going to start. Yeah, it's going to start at around the equivalent of $1,400 after you do exchanges and currency and all that stuff. So it looks pretty crazy. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to get a little drink of water and we can start wrapping this show up. Simon says, Hypno, expect pearl clutching and hand wringing to match the OnePlus 7 Pro's pop-up selfie camera concerns. Yeah, that aged pretty well. Like, I still have my OnePlus 7 Pro, and obviously I haven't used it this whole time, but, like, I haven't heard as many failures as I expected on that pop-up selfie. But it's been a lot of fun to kind of show off some of these differences. And then to also point out to people, like, this isn't an Apple versus Samsung thing. This is kind of a North American thing. The kinds of photos that I'm pulling off from these phones here are not indicative of, like, oh, if you leave iPhone, you get a better camera. Because Samsung and Apple don't feel like they need to compete. There's that... they're too big to care. This apathy that is just sort of like degrading all of their products. They want you to pay more year over year. They'll find reasons for why their phones should be getting more expensive every year. But if it's something like this and you really care about photography, nah. I'm planning a little write-up, and I don't know if it'll just be like a loose rambling Patreon post or if I'm really going to try and polish it up and publish it publicly. But I pulled this out just as a joke for a recent video. This is my Xiaomi 12S Ultra, 8 Plus Gen 1, 1-inch sensor, half-inch telephoto, ultra-wide. So this is a phone that is now two generations old, from 12S Ultra to 14 Ultra. And then I pick up something like my Pixel 8 Pro, and the photography performance between these two phones is... Well, I mean, it's like, it's really close and not foregone conclusion wins for the newer Pixel. And I want to see, like, when we finally start getting some word on, like, a Pixel 9, if I go back two generations on a Xiaomi, do I really expect that the Pixel 9 is going to outperform a Xiaomi 12S Ultra? If you had bought the Xiaomi 12S Ultra, and it was an expensive phone when it came out, would you still be competitive against a Pixel made for North America today? I think we've really fallen roughly 2 years behind other international products here in the United States. And tangibly, like, again, I care about, like, oh, well, I can zoom in 4K video across all the sensors on my Pixel. That's a really cool feature. Optically, the Xiaomi takes better photos. The depth of field is shallower. It looks more photographic. The Leica processing is so good and film-like and crunchy and vignette-y and all that kind of stuff that makes it feel like a photograph. Like, that's kind of frustrating to think, like, we're still spending a lot on these phones, but they haven't yet caught up to what the world was playing with 2 years ago. And I, it's a bummer of an article to write. Like, it makes me sad putting that all together. So, oh, Aditi, you know, absolutely just like that. Kind of like how the Lumia 1020 was able to hold its own even into, like, 2018, 2019. Physics plus a little knowledge of what you're doing goes a very long way. Absolutely agree. And it's telling because now you pick up, I have my Lumia 1020 right here. Actually, hold on, let me move it out of the way. So, like, here's my Lumia 1020. And I can pick this phone up now, and I can find some $400 phones. There are a couple $300 phones that have a main camera sensor that really is starting to compete with what we had on this 1020. It is the year 2024. And this phone is still not completely outclassed as a photography solution. This phone is crazy old and didn't even have, like, the most performant processor of its generation. And I can still pull this thing out, and with a little more work and a little more attention to those details, I got to work this phone, I've got to plan ahead, it is really slow, but I can still pull off some images from this thing that would go toe-to-toe with a good entry to mid-ranger level phone. It matters that we play with this kind of stuff and that we show these structural differences as we move from device to device to device, because we've gotten stuck in this kind of yearly apathy of promising, oh, it gets 10% better this and 15% more light this, and now you've got 200 megapixels and they're all delicious. And that doesn't really change your photography. But moving from a 1 over 1.3-inch type sensor to a 1-inch sensor, that changes your photography. It changes the look of your photos. It changes the feel. When I show someone I'm shooting this on a half-inch telephoto sensor with a roughly 100-millimeter equivalent focal length, you know, it is starting to close in on what a DSLR or a mirrorless with a cheap kit lens would have been able to accomplish. But I did it from a phone across a dark living room as, you know, people were putting out prayers and burning incense in a dark room, backlit. I'm pretty sure a lot of my photos from a phone were better than a lot of the mirrorless photos that were shot on cheaper lenses. They'll write it off. Oh, well, but he was just shooting on a phone. You know, I'm sure the photos would have been better if he'd had a real camera. You know, whatever shrug, because you know. But when you look at the photos, nah. They're doing fine. So it's an interesting place that we find ourselves in right now. I'll be very curious to see how Huawei does over the next, especially over this next year, as I feel a lot of regulators are going to be going after Apple and Google. And then I'll be very concerned to see, will there be some kind of regulatory pushback in like sort of the general Pacific area, like in Japan? Will Samsung face any kind of regulatory scrutiny over some of their business practices? Because they are, in many regions, like the second largest seller of phones. So I think we're in for kind of a domino effect. As regulators go after the top, if they find some small successes, then I think we're going to see that trickle-down effect hit other manufacturers too. So I think we should wrap this up. My voice is about to fail. I can feel it. Let me take this last little swig of coffee here, and then we'll close out this show. Folks, thank you so much for dropping by. I had a really fun weekend, and like again, I like being able to tell stories and kind of share some insights that aren't just like, I took this around my neighborhood to shoot photos of fire hydrants, and look at this random backyard photo that I took to show off the camera, and you can tell by the fact that I didn't focus on anything in my backyard that the HDRs aren't as good as an iPhone. I got another review, and it was of a budget phone, and it made me crazy, because that was the kind of photography that we saw in their review, and you're like, what are you even taking a picture of? And how come you can't even line up the horizon? Like, you're dutching. You could not have taken less effort. And I know the phone is cheap, but come on. The camera is so much better than the photographer in this review. And I'm sure the outlet paid money for someone to write that review. And it's just so bad. But I digress. Thank you, everybody, for dropping by and spending a little time with me. I like to kick off my week with these kinds of stories and interactions and getting to kind of share some different perspectives on these stories. We've got a lot that we need to keep an eye on, from government policy and FCC changes, FTC issues. We're going to probably be on a witch hunt for the chairwoman of the FTC. And then also seeing the DOJ case play out against EU regulations and more scrutiny over Google and Amazon and Apple. And it's a lot to kind of keep up with. For those of us that are entertained by the gadgets themselves, like our hobby is the technology and what we can do with the technology, this year's going to get busy. And it's going to get busy in very unconventional ways from where we were a couple years ago. On the happy side, it is really cool gadgets, laptops, mini computers, like that. That's, I'm like just salivating at where that's going to go. But then on the other side, we're about to see policy that's going to affect how all of these companies do business. And we know every single one of these companies is going to take a bad faith interpretation of those regulations to start, just like Apple did. Like, oh, you won't let us do this. Well, then we'll break this. And we need to be on top of it, because we also need to be those folks in our circles of family and friends who can kind of help guide. Find that relative who does not need a new iPhone and tell them about a battery refresh. Inflation is out of control. Money is really precious. The economy is doing great, and that's not making it down to people on the ground. That's only going to enrich the richest already. If your uncle doesn't need a new iPhone, tell him he can get a fresh new experience just by replacing the battery in his iPhone. That kind of stuff matters, and it brings us credibility. It helps elevate the nerd in the family that we actually know what we're talking about. And then when something really important happens, they'll seek us out for advice. We were right about that battery refresh. Hey, what's going on with my laptop? Okay, here's what we can do. And it's so much better for all of the people that you love and you care about to be there to help them out. So, folks, I want you to have an amazing week. There's going to be some fun videos and editorials and stuff coming to the channels, I promise. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care of yourselves so you can keep taking care of others. And I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.